Welcome to Inside Analog Photo. I'm your host, Scott Shepard, and the Inside Analog Photo radio program is brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful. Chrome, neg, black and white, instant, you name it. They got so much cool stuff going on. FujifilmUSA.com/professional, making life more colorful. Richard Photo Lab, the place to send all your black and white, your chrome, your neg. Excellent, excellent development work, prints, you name it. These guys are cooking it all up over at richardphotolab.com. Our friends over at Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com for the camera strap that will not let your camera slide off your shoulder. Really nice product. Al's a great guy. Check him out, upstrap-pro.com. And our media partners of the Analog Photography Users Group. You know, for a mere $24 a year, you can help support the APUG. It gives over 30,000 members a place to go on the web to talk about traditional photographic processes. I don't care if it's black and white, if it's chrome, if it's neg, if it's palladium, platinum printing, tintype. It doesn't matter if you're making your own emulsions, anything. It's all discussed over at APUG camera modifications, 35, medium format, ultra large, you name it. It's just rocking. And you know, for the $24, you get your own gallery, you get your own blog, and you're helping support the whole silver community. This is just too cool what's going on with these guys. It's the number one source on the web for this type of photography, and we need to keep this stuff alive. So check them out, apug.org. We got a great show lined up for everybody today. We're going to have with us Ron Mowry. Ron is a retired Kodak photochemical engineer. Ron's got some great stories. We're going to talk about his photography, how he was actually in the Air Force stationed at Cape Canaveral, shooting photos in quartz boxes with John Glenn, the Mercury missions, the Saturn missiles, him going to work for Kodak, what he did there for 33 years. We got stories about emulsion making. You know, just a lot of cool stuff that Ron's up to. Ron is also extremely very active at the Analog Photography User Group forums about making emulsions. He's been helping people make up new chemical, new papers, new black and white film. You know, he's got a lot of cool stuff going on. So we're just going to chat today in part one of our multi-part experience here with Ron about what he's been up to, what he's doing now. He's got some training DVDs that he's made up. He's got a book that he's working on, and he's doing classes, and there's a lot of cool stuff, and there's just a wealth of information from Ron that we're going to talk to him about. Today, we're going to go with a general overview, and then later on, we're going to get into more specific topics about making emulsions for black and white film, about making your own paper, about doing this stuff. You know, there's a lot of stuff. We could talk about this stuff for weeks, but today, we just have our one show to talk with Ron today about what's going on with him and what he's been up to. Hey, Ron, how you doing today?
Just fine. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you. Thanks for joining us here on Inside Analog Photo. Ron, you were an engineer at Kodak for many, many years. You're very popular and prolific here in the Analog Photography User Group forums on the web over at apug.org. You're really into photochemistry, making emulsions, and doing the truest form of photographic process. You're making your own stuff. You're making emulsions for people. You're doing a lot of great work. What I want to start off today with here, Ron, is tell us about yourself. How'd you get interested in photography, and how'd you end up at Kodak?
Well, long trail, starting back when I was about 8 years old. I had one uncle who was a professional photographer, among other trades, and my other uncle, because of my growing interest in the younger brother's photography, bought me a photo kit for Christmas gift. I started processing my own black and white between 8 and 12 years of age, and then at 12, I did my first Ektachrome E1, ran them through in kitchen sink with my mother's help. In fact, one of those pictures was used by Katine in his recent book on restoring negatives digitally. He used one of my color transparencies from that era. In any event, I worked my way through college in chemistry, working in a photo lab in Pittsburgh. I got a lot of help from John Frankowitz, who owned Penn Photo Company in Pittsburgh. We did some of the color in our own lab, some of the first color that was done outside of Kodak. We also did black and white for almost every photo store in the Pittsburgh area. When I finished college, I ended up being assigned by the Air Force to photo intelligence work, and I went to the Far East, Southeast Asia. We covered everything out of Japan and then finally Okinawa. Then I came back to the U.S. and was assigned to Cape Canaveral, where I became assistant director of still photography. While I was there, I met Paul Vidim, who was head of the color photography division at Kodak. We met at a photographic conference held at the Cape. And he said to me, hey, get out of the Air Force, get your graduate degree, and I'll give you a job. So I got out of the Air Force, went to graduate school, and next thing I knew, I had a job at Kodak. And I was working in Paul Vittem's division. That's pretty much what happened. And I spent 32 years at Kodak, all of it in the research labs. The first 15 years, I was a product engineer working on first color paper. And going back to my college days working for the photo finisher, I remember how difficult the process was and saying to myself, if I ever get a chance to work on color paper, I'm going to make the process simpler. And the first thing they said to me when I went to work for Kodak, well, we're going to get rid of cadmium and mercury in these emulsions. And while we're doing it, we were wondering if you were interested in making the process simpler. And I said, let me at it. So I worked on the first Blix for Kodak. And in fact, the Blix that's sold today for RA4 processing is derived from my formula, which at Kodak was called 1066. It was originally compounded in October of 1966. So I worked on Ektacolor paper, Kodacolor 400 film, Ektaflex, several products that never came out, such as a 3000 speed instant material, a copper-based imaging system. I made copper emulsions for a while.
Well, that must be interesting.
Oh, yeah. It was very, very interesting. I had to use polymeric materials instead of gelatin, and it was a real challenge. And after that, they assigned me to the emulsion division to work on modeling and scaling emulsions. I was not primarily an emulsion maker, but mostly I guess one of my friends said you were a comparative emulsionologist. I would get different emulsions and just compare them and work on, can this type be scaled, or is this within the model, and stuff like that. It was very math-intensive, computer-intensive, messy sometimes when I made mistakes.
Now, your original degree that you got when you went into the Air Force, what did you actually get a degree in?
I had a degree major in chemistry and a minor in mathematics.
So you were lined up perfect to do this stuff.
Yeah. And then when I got my graduate degree, I had a major in organic chemistry and a minor in biochemistry.
Did you find that the biochemistry helped you with the work you did at Kodak?
Not too much. No, I don't think so. All it did was stretch your mind, you know?
Right.
I was actually offered a job at Sloan Kettering Cancer Institute in New York City when I graduated based on my biochemistry, and I turned it down and took the one at Kodak.
Very interesting stuff. It must have been pretty cool, too, working at Canaveral during that time.
Yes, I got to meet 6 of the first 7 astronauts. I watched the liftoff of the first Saturn prototype, watched John Glenn and Alan Shepard and so forth all go into orbit. Had a lot of fun. Yep. Very, very interesting.
When you were shooting with the Air Force, what were you shooting?
Well, we were shooting Ektacolor S 4x5. We were shooting ECN. We were shooting 70 millimeter in a Holter camera. We were shooting 5-inch wide aerial ektachrome in aerial cameras at high speed. A lot of black and white, of course. The cameras were mounted in 1-inch quartz boxes to protect them from the blast because many of them were so close they would have been melted. And they were anchored to the ground by steel pins. And even so, we found several of them, you know, like several thousand feet away from the pad, just blown right off the mounting posts.
So they would put them in an optically clear quartz box.
Yes.
And somehow seal the box up and then strap it down to the ground.
That's right.
Wow. You have to admit, though, you guys did amazing images from that period in NASA's history where the stuff they got was so up close. And I guess, like you said, with these quartz boxes, doing that type of stuff, you don't even see that anymore.
That's right. I can remember my crew was the first one to sign on to John Glenn's pad after the launch. And I walked over to one of the camera sites, and one of the things laying on the ground was one of the explosive bolt pieces that blows away when the missile launches. And I reached down and went to pick it up, and it burnt my fingers. It was still so hot.
That's pretty fresh.
Yeah, I kicked it over into a puddle of water, and it cooled down, and I picked it up and shook it off and wrapped it up in a handkerchief, and I still have it here at home.
Cool souvenir there.
Yeah, I picked it up. I went down into the bucket where the flame comes out at the bottom, sloshed through the water, and looked up through the bucket. up at the sky where the missile lifted off from. You could just barely see it around the curvature of the bucket. The bucket was pretty much starting to melt. I think they could only use it two or three times because the flame would burn through the two-inch steel.
Wow, really interesting stuff. So let's talk about the stuff at Kodak, comparative emulsion work, and everything else you were doing at Kodak. What was the most interesting work that you did when you were at Kodak that you liked the best?
What did I like the best?
Yeah, what was your most favorite project when you were at Kodak?
I think I liked them all. They were all fun. I was like a kid in a candy shop. I could go in and do things that most photographers would love to do. I would go in and design a film, code it, and take it home and shoot it in my camera. I could do that, and I've done it. I could make a color paper and bring it home and make prints on it.
With unlimited resources at the time, Kodak was the monster giant from unbelievable amount of resources. You had no limitations, I guess, on what you probably could do.
That's true. Just as many executives bring homework home, my homework would consist of coming home and trying out some of these products in an amateur darkroom, which is what I have. You know, how well does it stand up under real use? I mixed and used some of the original Ektoprint 3 chemistry right here in my own home darkroom. I did everything from scratch.
There's the perfect test.
Yeah.
For R&D, you're using it in the environment that it was probably going to be used in.
That was exactly the intent of the whole exercise, yes.
Now, the other guys that worked on you with the projects at Kodak and the R&D labs, was everybody a shooter? Was everybody developing, cooking stuff at home? Or some people didn't care? They were like, okay, well, I'm going to go home. I don't care. I don't want to take no pictures right now. Goodbye.
It was an entire spectrum. Some people didn't care about photography, and some people were superb photographers that were world-renowned. The example I can give you is Grant Haste, who has been published in National Geographic. He's very well-known, also for his books.
How many people have typically worked on a project, and how long would you guys work on something when you were going through this emulsion comparing these different projects that you were working on? How long did something like this extend time-wise?
Okay. A project, depending on the amount of revision, you could take an existing product and improve it in, let's say, a year to 2 years. If you were doing design from scratch, it usually took around 5 years. Well, for example, when I worked on Gold 400 film, I worked on the magenta layer. I was a specialist on the magenta layer with a secondary responsibility for color reproduction of the entire film. We had two other people that were responsible for the yellow and cyan layers, and they had additional duties too, like film keeping and reciprocity failure and things like that. We each divided our jobs up like that, and then we had additional people who worked on the emulsions. So we had probably anywhere from 4 to 6 people working on any one film at a given time.
Now, with it being such a long duration to bring to market from original concept through your R&D with 4 or 5 years worth of work, does it get to the point to where you were just burned on a project, like, I'm just done with this, I want to move on to something else?
Very often, either one of two things would happen. Either you would get tired of it and they'd transfer you or move you on, or you'd become such a specialist, you'd move into a specialty position on that particular product and become a senior research associate that guided the future development of the entire family of films. And so we had SRAs, senior research associates, that were specialists in ektachrome film, reversal films, negative films, motion picture films, and so forth. It was a whole spectrum. It depended on the people.
Sure. Give us your thoughts on Kodak and how big Kodak really was at one point. I know during the heyday when you were there, Kodak was unbelievably huge, and I don't think people even realize how big Kodak was.
Okay, Kodak had, when I started, about 120,000 people worldwide. They had 6 manufacturing plants worldwide, including Australia, the U.S., Canada, France, and England. This also gives you a perspective of where I was in the company. I was just another worker bee. There are people far more capable of doing, for example, the emulsion work that you read about on APUG right now, than I am. I'm just one of the few that's been willing to continue on in it after I retired. But anyhow, the point being, with 120,000 people, research was an enormous operation, probably well over 2,000 people all by itself, just in the research labs.
You found that Kodak would put a lot of money back into research? They weren't chintzy or cheap when it comes to like, okay, well, you know, we're making millions of dollars every day on film. Let's put a bunch of money back into research to make even better stuff.
That's exactly what they did. We're making a lot of money on film. We're making a lot of money on paper. We're going to put it back into research as much as we can afford to come out with the next generation of better products. In fact, ever since the first day that color paper came out, contrary to what the scuttlebutt, one of Kodak's driving forces was good dye stability. Now, admittedly, they often missed the mark, but their driving force was dye stability. And in fact, we kept plots of it on charts to make sure we were doing well.
Ron, tell me about what you liked and what your dislikes were at Kodak, being there for 33 years.
Well, what I liked, as I said before, I was like a kid in a candy shop. I could go in and make coatings on coating machines that would make the members of APUG just go bonkers. I mean, I've seen all of the coating machines, coated at all different coating machine speeds, 14 layers at a time, and it was such a blast. But at the same time, you would get this feeling that, gee, I wish we could have gone in this direction instead of that direction. Or, I'm so sorry to see this project canceled. And I guess the biggest disappointment was to watch Kodak lose the lawsuits to Pavel, Polaroid, GAF, and so forth. We were sued by GAF because they had just come out with a new color paper when we came out with the Ektoprint 3 process. And they claimed in court that this obviated their color paper and destroyed it, so forth. And they won the case. But the thing was that their paper actually went through our new process just as good as our paper. You just had to alter the development times. But the courts didn't see it that way. Who am I to argue with the court? But it was certainly a disappointment to me personally to see that happen. Because after that, Kodak was very reluctant to put any change into the process because they were afraid of lawsuits. And so therefore, we had our hands tied and we couldn't make several changes that we had planned. For example, we had planned to replace CD3 with CD6. And all plans with CD6 were canceled except for Kodachrome.
Wow. Now, I can see that working on a project for 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years and you have a great thing going. It's like, okay, we're going to rev this now. We're going to make this change here. We're going to do this. And then the attorneys and the guys in the suits are like, no, you're not doing anything. Go work on something else. It's like they pulled the rug out from underneath you.
Yeah. We'd originally proposed the name Blix for the bleach fix in Ektoprint 3. And I can remember getting a telephone call from a guy up at sales. And he said, are you kidding? This name sounds like a child's toothpaste. And I said, hey, we thought it was a catchy name. And besides, everybody in the trade kind of uses that as an abbreviation. Well, we didn't use it. Pavel, or somebody, I don't remember who, trademarked it and used it themselves. And so we were restricted. So everybody else can use the word Blix now, except Kodak. That was a disappointment.
Yeah, it's very disappointing. I mean, like you said, you work on this stuff and they pull the rug out from underneath your feet and say, too bad.
Yeah, I can remember when we lost the lawsuit to Polaroid and they just told us all coating time is canceled. Dump all your emulsions into the silver reclamation system. Send all of the organic chemicals out to be destroyed in the incinerators. They had these special incinerators that destroyed the chemistry without air pollution. They had these big carbon scrubbers in them and everything. Then we were all told that we would either be assigned new jobs or would be allowed to search for new jobs within Kodak. But that was a big disappointment too.
So what happened with the Polaroid gig? Because what you guys were doing were different than Kodak, different emulsion, different way of the photo being taken by the camera. The Kodak instant was shot from the back, correct? Compared to where Polaroid was shot from the front.
That's correct. Kodak used a black goo and Polaroid used a white goo. And the picture in the Polaroid appeared on the goo itself. Whereas with the Kodak, the image had to diffuse through what we call a white rug behind that black goo. We used emulsions that gave direct reversal images. And Polaroid used negative emulsions that caused direct positive dye images to form. So everything was totally different. And yet the judge said, nope, looks the same to me. It makes a photographic positive image. That was a disappointment because I remember the attorneys I was deposed on several lawsuits, and I remember the attorney saying, don't worry, this stuff is looking pretty good. And then just to have it turn south was a disappointment.
So, Ron, tell me, you retired after 33 years at Kodak. I think you probably saw the writing on the wall that it was time to bail before you had involuntary retirement. Tell me about what you're up to now. What's going on? What's Ron doing?
Well, I'm making emulsions in my home darkroom. I'm developing a series of emulsions, which includes an azo-type emulsion, a codabromide-type emulsion, and an ISO-40 orthochromatic emulsion that kind of duplicate things from around the 1920s to 1940s era. It's easy to make by home darkroom enthusiasts, and I'm also doing a little bit of consulting for a couple of customers. I have several clients. I just shipped off 3 emulsion experiments to a client this week. I plan on getting into some more complex emulsion making using pumps and ultrafiltrators, so that high-end hobbyists or clients who are interested in this type of work can do more advanced emulsions. If my work is successful, I will be able to make ISO 100 to ISO 400 emulsions. They should be much simpler to make, but they will cost a little bit more to set up in the darkroom.
That's great stuff you're working on. It's cool that you're still working and developing things and making things that people can do themselves as a craft.
I've also been challenged by a couple of people, can I do color? So I do have the materials on hand now, except for one ingredient, to make a trial dye bleach material like Ilfochrome color. Within the next year, I hope to make a couple of single color and maybe 2 color coatings just to demonstrate it on APUG for people.
Now, you find typically with a color emulsion, if it's a reversal chrome or a negative film, we're talking, what, 12, 14, 16 layers?
Yes, but a print material like Ilfochrome might get by with 3 layers.
Something you could realistically do yourself then?
Yes. I actually did a 3-layer Ilfochrome at Kodak and it worked. I'll be giving that a try.
Well, always fun stuff going on. Why do you see that people want to create their own emulsions in the darkroom when you can basically just go out and buy film? You can buy film, you can buy paper. Is this something that is missing in the market, that somebody wants a nostalgic look from a certain type of emulsion from a certain time period in traditional photography process? Or is it more of people like to tinker, they like to create with their hands, they want something tactile, they want to be the mad scientists and make something that actually works?
I think you hit the entire gamut right on the head. There are people who will pay a lot of money for a very authentic looking period photo. And this would go clear back to daguerreotypes or ambrotype or even what I'm trying to do, the early 20s. And so with one of my materials, you can go out and make a glass lantern slide and do a lantern slide show. I have a friend that works over at George Eastman House who on the side, or maybe as his main hobby, he and his wife make period photographs of people dressed in period costume from back in the 20s and 40s.
So in theory, he would want your emulsion because when it's developed and processed, it's going to look just like the stock you would have shot in 1926. Boom.
Oh, he has his own emulsions that are excellent. He has an ISO 3 and an ISO 6 emulsion, which he uses for teaching purposes at George Eastman House, which takes beautiful photographs, and I've posted a few of those on APUG with his permission, along with the formula. Then he makes albumen prints, and he teaches courses under a grant from Mellon.
All there in Rochester?
Yes, at George Eastman House.
Very interesting stuff going on. It's very cool to see what people are still making stuff, and you wouldn't think that a band of all you guys ex-Kodak engineers are cooking stuff up in the basement. It's pretty cool.
Yes. A group of us, there's about 8, meet over at George Eastman House about once every other month, and we get together and have lunch and show each other results. One of us has a digital camera with a 3D image splitter, and he can take 3D digital images, which he can put up on his HDTV and view with Polaroid glasses and get a 3D image, or he brings them in with an old stereo imager, and he's printed them out with a Kodak printer, and we look at stereo color images. Beautiful stuff. Each one of us is doing something different.
What have you seen with the other guys that were at Kodak doing what you were up to and that was in your guys' labs that are embracing digital, still doing analog or doing both? And maybe I guess we can touch off on what's your thoughts here on this whole digital photography. And I wouldn't say digital as photography. I would say digital imaging instead of photography. So what's your thoughts on what's going on with digital and what's Ron up to?
I'll start out with what I'm doing. I have been trying to see how good a scanned medium format or large format or even 35 millimeter negative and transparency can be printed onto digital material. And I've found that I can get as good or better quality through a scanned negative and then a digital print. I've made 13 by 19 prints from 35 millimeters that look as good or better than optical prints on my enlarger. Now, that leaves aside the image stability because the digital image will become less sharp over time because the inks tend to blur, just like a tattoo will blur on a human arm or something.
Right.
And the dyes are not stable, are some of the chromogenic materials yet. Apart from image stability, I can get very high quality from digital print. So there may be a hybrid intermediate ground that is very good in quality. But to go directly digital to digital, starting with a digital original, I find that the tone scale is very abbreviated in a digital original because it is inherently a reversal image. And reversal images, by their very nature, tend to impose toe on toe and shoulder on shoulder. It's kind of like an image compression, if you will, and you lose detail. And the second problem is the aliasing, because you have dots side by side by side instead of stacked as they are in color film. And so as a result, in finely grouped clusters of color objects, you get patterns, this pixelization that shows up that shouldn't be there. And so if I have a direct digital image, even from a very high quality camera, as soon as you try to enlarge it, you can start to see the pixelization. And it wouldn't be until they get a stack or a three-sensor system that you would begin to get rid of that problem. That's where I'm coming from.
Yeah, that's very interesting stuff there with that. And very cool to see that you're playing around with this hybrid workflow. Like you said, you can get some beautiful prints from a brand new Epson Ultrachrome K3 ink set. I mean, this stuff is so sharp it makes your eyes bleed. And I think if you drill down, there is some issues.
Yes, Wilhelm's site does show bleeding of images. The other thing is that the last time I looked at some of the pigments, which could conceivably be better, you got kind of a relief image on the surface of the Epson print. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, because I think the pigment is polymer encapsulated, so you actually have a solid material building up.
Yes, and to me, that detracts from what I want in a very nicely glossed surface. So if I want a glossy print, I can't get one with a digital pigment printer.
You know, the digital stuff is beautiful, and like you said, I'm wondering how long it really takes for a print to start losing sharpness.
Probably not too long. My impression from talking to some conservators in the image area would confirm that a digital print probably would only be usable for about 20 to 40 years. Whereas a current chromogenic print would withstand the same conditions for up to 200 years. Now, there is a big difference of opinion between Kodak and Fuji over the lifetime of their paper. I would say that they're probably both comparable, but you see Kodak tests under, I believe it's 100-foot candles, and Fuji tests under 500-foot candles. Because of what's called reciprocity dye fading effects, the two products test differently under those conditions, and you can't compare them. You have to test them under the same conditions, probably both conditions, to be fair. So I would say that Fuji, Crystal Archive, and Endura probably both will last around 200 years.
And it is really handy, though, too, to be able to scan a nice piece of negachrome and then pop it out of your Epson in 15 minutes and go, wow, look at this cool print hanging on the wall.
That's the thing that's selling digital. People want to look at it right away.
Right. Now, if you have a dark room, you can actually cook your stuff up and go make a print real quick.
Yeah, and if I don't happen to have any paper around, I just make up a batch of emulsion, coat it, and print it.
Right, there you go.
Actually, right now, I'm doing that. It takes about 1.5 hours. Total prep time is 1 hour to make the azo emulsion. I can coat from one little batch of azo emulsion, I can coat about 20 to 40 sheets of 8x10, and then I can go down into the darkroom and bang out. I get like about a 90% yield of perfect sheet, and I can print out, say, 15 to 18 8x10s, contact print. That's a pretty nice printing session, and I'm using azo paper, and I can coat it on any surface I want. I've coated on tapestry, canvas, watercolor, just plain Strathmore smooth, Baryta matte, Baryta glossy, extra rough Baryta. They all look beautiful.
Now, what's typically different, Ron, with the emulsion that you're making and what somebody would consider or buying like liquid light in a bottle?
That's a fair question. Liquid light, I believe, is made by Rockland Colloid, and they use a typical chlorobromide emulsion formula from about the 40s, probably one of the old Agfa Brovera formulas, which is actually pretty close to what I make. All I've done is simplify the formula so that a home darkroom enthusiast doesn't have to learn a lot of chemistry and doesn't have to spend a whole day in the darkroom.
Ron, let's talk about what you're doing here. You have some DVDs that you've just finished producing. Let's talk about how people can learn what's going on here. You have some great training stuff coming up. And of course, we're going to have you back talking about all kinds of stuff because we just sort of skimmed over the surface today about what Ron's up to and what you've been doing. But tell us here about the DVDs and what you're doing here with this training.
Okay. I'm writing a book. I've got 120 pages of it done. I've realized that it's probably going to be around 200 pages long when I'm done. The file is probably around 50 meg long because of all of the diagrams and flowcharts and photographs that are included in it. And then I did the DVD, and it turned out we had to do it in two parts. There's about an hour and a half on the first DVD and 45 minutes on the second DVD. The first DVD is divided into four parts: how to set up your darkroom and practice how to coat. The second part is how to make an azo emulsion. Third one is making the ISO 40 orthochromatic emulsion. And the fourth part is how to test your results. The second DVD shows how to do ultrafiltration and how to make a pumped make of an emulsion. So it's basically advanced techniques. The position I'm in right now, the DVDs are done, and I have to go back through and synchronize what I've already written with the DVDs because I had to take some things out of sequence to make the DVD seem more free-flowing.
Right.
So the DVDs have been made. My videographer, excellent young man who's been our next-door neighbor for years, is now off in Australia, so I had to get everything done in a rush before he left. They would be ready for sale, but stand alone, they don't teach enough. You can understand that you need to have the formula written out in front of you rather than somebody saying, take 4 grams of this and 6 grams of that and so forth. You need to see the formula written down in front of you, and so the book and the DVD will be on sale together.
Great stuff you're working on. So where's the best place to go to actually see what you're doing? Do you have a website set up? Are you going to put a site up here for the book and the DVD? Do you expect both these pieces to be out at once, or are you going to have the DVD ship first and the book will be available later?
I'm thinking of having both of them ship at the same time, with the DVDs being a little flap at the back of the book or something. Then it'll save shipping costs for the customer. It'll be a little more economical that way for me, too. It takes me, on my computer, about 2 hours to burn a set of DVDs. So what I'm looking for now is a way to get some mass production of them. I'm trying to look for the publisher for this. I'm working with a few people on self-publishing or finding a publisher. It's all slow work. I guess it probably won't be ready for general sale until next. The only people that could probably handle the DVDs right now are people who have taken my workshops, and I'm thinking of making them available to them. I'm not sure if I will be teaching a workshop next summer. That's still being under discussion with the formulary because they don't do their scheduling till around Christmas time.
Really interesting. So I guess the best place to go at this point is you can check back with InsideAnalogPhoto.com because we'll have the information posted on what you're doing And also, if people want to follow what you're up to, they can just go over to apug.org at the Analog Photography User Group and see what's going on in the emulsion and the development section, where you're very prolific and post all kinds of information on all kinds of great traditional processes.
Yes, and I'd like to thank Sean Ross over at apug.org for his kind help in getting that set up and going. You will see actual scenes from the DVD taken in infrared light on APUG right now.
So, Ron, I know that recently, because of all your work, what you're doing with the emulsion making and the stuff you're helping people do themselves over at APUG, Kodak has actually talked about what you're up to. Tell me about what's going on with that.
Kodak publishes an internal CTO newsletter. That's the chief technology officer of Kodak. It's a book about 20 pages long, a nice glossy book. And they picked up on my work and kind of wrote an article, "Yes, there is photographic life after retirement," and wrote a nice full-page article about my work for dissemination within Kodak. This was done last quarter of last year, so it's almost a year ago now. It includes photographs made on my azotype paper by Alex Hawley, one of the APUG members who tested my paper. It includes comments by some of my students. And I was very flattered that Kodak took notice of it. They have kind of given me a venue to say, "Thanks, Kodak, you taught me a lot, and now I'm doing it to try and teach people." I guess that's about all I can say about it.
Now they need to let you just come back in and say, "Well, Ron, just come back and use the labs. We don't mind. This is cool what you're working on."
Well, I kind of hinted about that to a couple of people there, and they said, "No way, Jose." No way. No way. Even though I have a Kodak pass yet, it says retiree on it. If I swipe it, nothing happens.
Gets you in the company store or the cafeteria, and that's about it, huh?
Actually, it also gets me into the library if I make an appointment. That I've been told that. In fact, I can actually go almost anywhere unescorted with a prior appointment. In fact, several years ago, I taught a course at Kodak over at the Elm Grove plant when they were trying to retrain people into computers. Because of my extensive work on process control at Kodak Park, they called me in to teach a course in computers for these people who were being cross-trained. So I have done work at Kodak since I've retired. I was called in to consult on another occasion, too, on a swellometer problem at Kodak Park. So that's about it.
Ron, I really appreciate you joining us today, talking about what you've been up to, what's going on with your current work. And, of course, all the great work you're doing on over at APUG and just developing emulsions and doing all this contract work. And everything you're doing is just really cool to help extend this great process of analog photography and everything you're up to.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you.
We're definitely going to have you back, so you can definitely look forward to having more information from Ron. We're going to be chatting about some of the stuff he's doing and getting more in-depth on the emulsions that he's making, the stuff for the paper, for film, and all the great work you're doing. And like I said, Ron, thank you so much. Great work you're doing, buddy.
Thanks. Have a good day.
There you go, Ron Mowry. Isn't that cool? Ron's got such great stories. You know, when Kodak was this monster giant company, and it was like bigger than the government, and these guys were cranking out emulsions like crazy, and all these people and 2,000, 3,000 people in development teams, and all these scientists making all this stuff, and look at what happened. It's just a crazy, crazy story, but it's great stuff. It's very cool to see that Ron is still making stuff. He's in the dark room. He's making emulsions for people. You can make your own paper. You can make your own black and white film if you want to replicate what was shot in the 20s and 30s. And he's getting into more and more progressively difficult emulsion making and just great stuff going on. So like I said, you can find out more information really about what Ron's up to. Just go over to the APUG.org website and look under the section of emulsion making. And you can just see all the stuff that Ron's put up there. There's a lot of great information, great stories. And of course, we're going to have Ron back here many times on Inside Analog Photo talking about making your own paper, talking about making your own film. There's so many things you can do and have fun with, and this is a craft. Photography is a great, great craft, and especially silver-based photography is just so cool. So like I said, check it out over at apug.org. Ron's got all the stuff going on over there, and you can look forward to having more Ron Mowry here on Inside Analog Photo. I'd like to thank the sponsors of the program, Fujifilm over at fujifilmusa.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends over at Richard Photo Lab at richardphotolab.com, Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. Our friends over at apug.org, the place on the net to find out everything about the traditional analog photography process. I've been your host, Scott Shepard, here on Inside Analog Photo. You can find out more information about what we're up to over at www.insideanalogphoto.com.